The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
So thank you, everyone. It was nice sitting together. One of my favorite mantras is find your body, find your breath, find the present moment. It's become a mantra. So if that's helpful for you to think of that as a way to come back when the mind gets confused or disassociated, you just find my body, find my breath, oh yes, find the present moment. So it's just that close. Why don't we do a couple moments here of stretching, if you need to stand up or use the restroom before we start. Stretch your legs out if you need to. Okay. Guys are all so quiet. I'm sort of used to community a little unruly. We have to beat the bell a few times, you know, social. But yeah, I also like the stillness too. Thank you. So tonight I just wanted to share a few reflections about our path of working with the heart. And also the purification that comes through the spiritual life, especially when you're committed. So I want to make sure this is loud enough. Can you hear me okay? No, it's not loud enough. All right, let's try to go up even a little bit more. Because if we go up on the main volume, it goes... Yeah, is that better? Okay, thank you for raising your hand. If it goes down, I'll try to project more of a softer voice, but... I'll use my power voice. So I wanted to share about the path of working with the heart and purification that comes. A lot of the work that I do at Spirit Rock or traveling or in different communities is talking about the heart practices, especially metta practice and practices about self-love. What I discovered in this community, and it really started to happen when I was in teacher training. Jack Kornfield has been my really dear mentor for 20 years. Since I was very young, I met him. And then I went into teacher training, which was 6 years at Spirit Rock, and I've been out of that training for many years now. But it was during that training that I had some very important insights. And a lot of that training was sitting in and listening to people report about their practice. So they would be on a one-month retreat or a 10-day retreat, and also sat with many other really great teachers. And I would listen all for hours, all mornings on retreats, the whole morning period, to people report about what they were experiencing in their meditation. And that was very valuable for some of you who might be, you know, clinical psychologists or in therapy program. A lot is observation as part of training, right? Anything is observation. Science is that too, right? You're learning through observing, listening, and witnessing. And I was really surprised during that period, because one of the things that I noticed is that, in my mind, people were not progressing through what are called the stages of insight. And the stages of insight is what insight meditation is about. It's seeing the nature of things. It's seeing suffering. It's seeing impermanence. It's seeing not self. And those insights are very important to see, because what that does is it chops down the tree of delusion, right? When we start to see that, what happens is our clinging becomes, less. We stop believing in delusion as much, right? We start to see things for how they are, and that leads to a lot of happiness, right? The less you cling, the happier you are. That kind of correlates, right? Clinging, suffering, letting go, freedom, right? We can recognize that on some level. So insights are really important. And in the Theravada tradition, which this comes out of, Vipassana tradition comes out of this Southeast Asia and Sri Lanka and Thailand and Burma, and this early wave of Dharma, Buddhism, that they call it the first turning of the wheel. These insights are important, and you look for them, and they happen quite naturally. They happen to everybody over time. But I was really surprised when I was on retreat, because I would, after the interviews were over, I would meet with all the teachers, and I would say, wow, only very few people are having insight. And I felt sad about it. Most people, it felt that there was this great struggle. And I was really interested in that struggle, actually, because that's the struggle of all of us. And every now and then, we would see somebody come in, and they would be going through the stages of insight. And teachers get really happy about that. They're like, yes, this person, right? They're kind of, because as a teacher of anything, if you're a math teacher, you want your students to get the equation, right? And those who do, you're like, yes. You know, it's kind of, you get invested in that, right? Especially if you imagine you're teaching a three-month retreat. You're invested in the end of suffering. You want to see, you know, people being happier, getting the breakthrough that they're looking for, growing in their own way. And people were growing. That's not to say that they weren't. It was just surprising for years to hear very similar stories. So what I started to notice was the people who were having insight, who were, there seemed to be a particular type of person. They had a particular view of reality, and that was this view and this personality. And I think a lot of these qualities, we call them paramis, right? These qualities of natural knowing. The 10 paramis are part of this tradition. I won't go into that teaching so much, but they had the key to what they had was a lot of self-love and self-compassion. That was it. And they could meet their experience with this openness that other people could not, right? They could meet the deluded mind, basically. They could meet all of the ego with all of its fury and confusion. And they could meet the, you know, the Mara in the mind, the demons, right? They could meet their demons with a sense of compassion, instead of getting kind of thrown off and sidetracked. And, you know, I always use this analogy of boats going downstream, because for me, the mind represents like a stream of consciousness, right? The flow, the stream of understanding. And imagine that there's 7 billion people and they're all in their boats, right? Here we are going down the stream. We're all in our little canoes or whatever, boats, you know, kayaks, whatever have you. And those who have a lot of love and compassion, sort of this innate sense of it for themselves, they're not, sort of their mind isn't so much turned against them. And you know what I'm talking about, that critic, right? That inner critic. It's like constant monologue of you're not doing it right, bad, wrong, bad. It's so painful, actually. And it's rooted in this Western psyche. It's some kind of collective karma we share. Right? It's like we have everything, but if your mind's against us, we have nothing in a way, right? It's like, the mind, I have everything else is lined up. Like my thinking could get there, right? So this is our problem, right? This is our, you know, this is our what we have to bear. And so imagine these boats, coming back to that for a moment. The people who had this innate quality, my grandmother was like this. She had this innate goodness that, oh my gosh, I can't imagine anyone who could deal with more drama and suffering and still have this cheerfulness, right? And she attributed it to Jesus. And I was like, no, you're just like that, you know? I mean, 8 kids, drama, being a maid and all the suffering of all, everyone, you know? And she'd be like, let's keep on keeping on, you know? And I'd be like, wow, nothing kind of, right? I wish that I could have taught her Dharma before she got dementia. Even if I could have shown her concepts or ideas, she already kind of had it already. It was just more packaged and understood much more through the Christian mysticism, which has a beautiful thread, right? A beautiful aspect to it. So those people who have that quality, it's like they're going down the river and there's all the waves and all the storms and everything is happening, you know, life gets stormy, you know, if you're in a rapid and, you know, it's still for a while and then suddenly, it speeds up and then you almost flip out. They don't flip out of the boat. They're able to ride the current and stay upright. And somehow that togetherness and the stability of a mind that is rooted in compassion is strong. It's steady in the face of the storm. But others that don't have that quality yet so established, it was like their boats were tipping over every 5 minutes. So if you've ever flipped over in a kayak, a boat, it's a lot to get upright again, right? And you're tiring and you put all your stuff and then you go again, you get it, and then flip. So you're getting down, of course, but how are you getting down the river? And how long does it take? So these were questions that I really started to grapple with. And all of the teachers actually do grapple with this idea and this what is happening collectively. So you will see a huge amount of meta retreats come online. Now Spirit Rock went to having 1 to 3. Which I teach 1 to 2 a year there. IMS has Insight Meditation. These are the big centers. If you don't know what I'm talking about, don't worry. They're just the big meditation centers that many of the teachers come through. You certainly don't have to know about them. But so this is kind of what I wanted to speak to tonight about as we grow on the path. And I think I really, in some way, I'm talking to the choir here. Because Minnesota, everyone's really nice here, you know. I just came from St. Louis. I was doing 4 days of teaching, and it was different in St. Louis, you know. And then when I got here, everyone was like, hello, hi, you know. I was like, oh. And then I was talking to a taxi driver, and he said, it's called the Minnesota niceness. That's not to say there's not problems, obviously, right? We're not saying that. But there is a kind of that innate movement toward a friendliness, which can be helpful. However, it doesn't really matter so much on the outside. It's how are we with ourselves? How are we behind closed doors? So I want to start off telling you this little joke. I'm sure some of you have heard it before. It's a Dear God letter. Dear God, so far today I have done all right. I haven't gossiped, I haven't lost my temper, I haven't been greedy, grumpy, nasty, selfish, or overindulgent. I haven't smoked or drank or cussed anyone out, haven't lied, stolen, or cheated anyone. I am thankful for this. But in a few minutes, Lord, I'm going to get out of this bed. And from then on, I'm probably going to need a lot more help. Signed, trying desperately to be spiritual. So that's more like how I practice it, right? On some level, just getting through things. And so there's a certain amount of understanding this is the path of purification, you know, and it's not about trying to be perfect, right? It's about understanding that we will meet the shadows and how do we embrace that. And so that's a lot about what my book is about. That's why I call it a fierce heart, right? Because there's a certain fierceness you have to muster when you want to meet the insane parts of your mind and let go. There's a certain kind of, this is kind of a warrior path in a way. Chogyam Trungpa, the Tibetan teacher, who was controversial to say the least, but also as part of his mind, completely brilliant. He used to look at his students and go, you know, you should just go home right now. You don't really want to wake up. You don't. It's too hard. You know, he would say all these things, right? And he would talk about other times he would come into Dharma talks and he would challenge all the students. This is in the 70s, different style then. He would tell them all, everyone should just get naked, take all your clothes off right now, reveal everything, because this is what it is to be on the path, you know. And then people would go, is he serious? Are we supposed to take our clothes off? Now, I wouldn't do that. I don't think anyone else would. But you see the level that he's pointing to, that there's a realness that comes when you're growing in insight, and there's a certain shedding. And we need a lot of love and compassion to kind of meet that process. It can't be done with a baseball bat, right? It cannot. It has to be done through the heart. And it took me a long time to understand. I was also practicing a lot in the Tibetan tradition. Actually, Tergar International, which is located here in Minneapolis, is a great lama, and they are named Mingcho Rinpoche. And I took refuge with him and followed him for many years and appreciated the work of his father, who was a great, great yogi master, and his brother Sokni. So there's a little enclave of the Tibetans here. And he would talk about that, how the shedding and how much compassion is needed. And I didn't understand it for many years, why Tibetans stressed it. I mean, that was their whole main thing. And then I started to grow more. And I started to say, oh, right, because when you meet these parts of your mind, the only weapon you really have is to open to it with compassion, right? To fight invokes a sort of delusion, like to see its true nature, it has to be sort of go through the heart. So I have a chapter in my book where I have a chapter called Love is the Answer. And I write that because love has been the answer to all of my questions. Whenever I'm grappling with something, I say, can you love this moment? And the answer often is no, right? Can I? Oh. That's what we often say. I will not accept this. This is unacceptable. And usually the next thing is, and so are you, right? To ourselves and the other person. But I will not accept that this is happening. I will not accept it. I feel like this, right? I will not accept that this is whatever these conditions are. I don't accept them. And in that non-acceptance, we tip our boat over. We collapse the boat. And so I talk about in this chapter and in another chapter, I talk about this 5-month retreat that I did. And I decided a few years back, I was really burnt out on all my projects. I had so many different projects going. And I was doing all of them on donation, and I was, you know, really putting beautiful seeds in the ground, right? Doing a lot of work with communities that were in need. And I just had reached this point where I thought, I need a break and I want to do a long retreat. So I decided to do a 5-month retreat. And I thought about where to go for a long time, and I decided in Crestone, Colorado. And for many of you, have you ever been to Crestone? It's really a magical place because there was a family that owned almost, I don't know, 1 million acres there, a huge amount of land, like all the whole city, it seemed like, was owned by this family. And it went into a trust, and the woman who had all of the sort of the authority, she decided to give it all away. And she gave it to all these spiritual organizations. So in the 70s and 80s, so all the Tibetans got a whole bunch, the Zen community, all these different Hindu gurus have a space there. Sokni Rinpoche has a space there. There's Native American groups there, do sweat lodges. So the whole city kind of has a spiritual vibe. And there's a Tibetan monastery there and a big stupa that has the remains of a great lama, the 16th Karmapa. And there's these cabins, and there's people in the cabins doing life retreat. So then I found out, as I decided to go into a cabin, that there was cabins spread all over that area with people doing very intense meditation practices. And there was also a nun's hermitage there. And so it was really amazing in that way, and a huge yoga community. And there was only a few stores in the downtown, like maybe a little hotels and an organic store. And so there was a retreat center that I decided to sign up to. It was only 8 people could fit in the retreat center. And I stayed there. I was going to do compassion practice for 5 months because that's how much I needed it, right? I was just so tired and depleted. And So I ended up staying there for 2 months, and then one day a nun came and she talked about this mountain where there was like a mystical cabin. And I was like, oh, really? A mystical cabin? I want to go there, right? And then, of course, I imagine all these great moments. I'll be outside with, you know, the nature, and I'll connect to the mountain. You know, when you want something, you only imagine the beautiful qualities of that experience. You know how it is. You plan something, and you're like, it'll be so great. So I go up to see the cabin, and it's really small and has a little solar panel, so I have a little few hours of light at night, and there's an outhouse, and it was way out there. I didn't have a phone, computer, nothing, and the caretaker was this kind of crazy older man, sort of mystical. He would bring water up every 10 days and just put it on the deck. And then I arranged for the little organic store. They used to help yogis and yoginis in retreats, so they were like, we'll be very happy, you know, you just pay ahead, we'll deliver fresh food for you every 10 days with the water. We'll arrange that. And so I went to this journey up there, and I was going to do, I just bought this huge stack of Dharma books. That was all I had. And they were very hardcore Dharma books. It was like The Nature of Mind, 1 through 10 volume, you know. It wasn't light reading, it was like emptiness, and you know, I didn't understand a lot of it, you know. I was like, what, you know. So I thought, the worst thing that will happen to me up here is a feeling. I can deal with feelings. What's that? I can be with that. So as the caretaker was dropping me off at this, you know, and we hiked up, the road was so bad they could just come up and then haul stuff, and there I am, and he's driving off, and he goes, okay, I'll see you in 10 days, you're gonna be great. And then as soon as he drove down the hill, I was like, no, I changed my mind, wait. And I descended, the underworld descent came for, it started off with this terrorizing fear as it got dark. And I could hear stuff outside, so I shut. It was a tiny little cabin. I shut all the curtains, and I could hear stuff rattling around, and I just shook all night in this kind of primal fear, waves and waves of fear. I couldn't sleep, so I just waited for the sun to rise. And then when the sun rose, oceans of tears started to fall, oceans upon, they just poured out. And that was the first day. And then a week later, it was still happening. Terror all night long, oceans of water pouring out. And I couldn't believe it. It was like, what is happening? And it started to go on day after day, and I thought, I can't make it. After about 3 weeks, I said, I don't know what's happening, but I can't do this. This is madness. Who would do this to themselves? And then I started to pray for love and compassion, because I knew something important was happening. I knew it was like, this was what was depleting me at home. Like, I knew this was purification. And that word began to be important as I found some autobiographies in the cabin of great masters, and I was reading them, and I was thinking about the heart. And I thought, the only way I can meet this pain is with love. I've got to find some deeper place in me that can be with this. And with that, I started to do these practices of metta and compassion. And it went on and on and on. All night, the primal fear. I just waited all night to be murdered and hacked to death. Just any moment. It was like some primal unwinding. I would watch myself shake like a leaf. I couldn't eat anymore. I got very thin. And my mind clicked on this wakefulness. It wouldn't go to sleep. It was just, it was like a vision quest that never ended for 3 months, you know, on and on. So I had to just be with this kind of process that was happening. And so one night, the story I really want to tell is one only way I can go to sleep at night at this tiny little bed, maybe just no, almost the same size as this little area here. Only way I could go to bed was I would stuff all these pillows behind me. And I would imagine, I would like go like this, and I would imagine being like wrapped around the arms of the Great Mother, and I would sink into these giant bosoms. I would pack it like, you know, bosoms, you know how. And then I'd be like curled up, you know, very childlike, right? I mean, isn't that the ultimate comfort is a baby with wanting to be close to the, to nurse, to the mother or something, you know, that pacifies that primal energy that I was experiencing. And so I could sleep for a couple hours, but I just want to tell this one story. So I fell asleep for a couple hours one night and had an extraordinarily vivid dream. And in that dream, a deva came down, and I was having all kinds of mystical experiences there. All kinds of things were happening, sort of when you get into an altered state like that. You're sort of one dimension here and another, you know, one foot in another. And so I had this dream, this beautiful deva comes down, celestial being, and she says, "Spring," very elegantly, "would you like to put all your weapons here?" And it was this huge bag. And she said, "all of your weapons." And by then I had cried so many tears, and I had saw the roots of it a lot were in rage and anger and hatred. I saw old actions I had been doing. It was the purification also was that I was doing even a lot of prostrations. So I was doing purification practices and mantras in the Tibetan tradition. And so she said, "would you like to put your weapons?" And without even a hesitation, I cried so many tears, "get rid of them. Yes, I would like to put them there." And then out from the center of my heart, out of my whole chest area, came whole huge military tanks. You know how you see exodus of like one country leaving another and the military going out? That went on, and I remember I had this huge sigh, and it was just going out and out. And then came all these weapons, like semi-automatics and guns, and you know those weapons like nunchucks and flying darts and ninjas. And then all these gangsters came out, the ones I used to grow up with when I was a kid, right? All the gangsters, the whole gangsters coming out yelling, and then atomic bombs coming out and swords of every type that you could have. It went on for a half an hour. It was a hellacious amount of weaponry, right? And so then I woke up and the sun was coming up. And I remember I went out onto the ground. It was the first day. It was coming to be more warmer in the springtime. And I went outside and I felt so naked. And then it came to me as I sat down on the ground, what am I going to do now without my weapons? And this voice said, "honey, those weapons you used on yourself, that was what you decimate yourself with every day." And I could see that, right? How do we, the way we talk, the way we like, so painful. And it took me a long time to integrate from that retreat. I went home and I felt great. It all stopped at the end. It's amazing how the mind works. As soon as the end started coming, it was like the water started drying. It was like the rainbow after the rainstorm, you know. And I don't recommend that kind of thing for everybody. After that, when people ask me about going on solo retreats, I was like, you have to be very careful. You know, I was able to get through that experience. So also, you know, I was thinking a book. I wanted to just share a little bit about a book, too, that I really liked a lot that I read last year, and it stayed with me. It was a book by Ram Dass called Paths to God. I love this book, by the way. I rarely read a Dharma book or a meditation book or a spiritual book where I'm laughing out loud the whole time. And the book actually is a commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. And most of the book, he wrote about him and his guru, Neem Karoli Baba. And it's the most hysterical stories with him and his guru. And you know his, Ram Dass, for some of you who don't know, he's the 85-year-old teacher. He lives in Hawaii now. He was really at the forefront of a, you know, kind of a 60s revolution. He wrote Be Here Now, which is basically, it's not a lot to that book. It's mostly his acid trip in the middle, but people like it. That the whole middle part are the crazy drawings that you're like, what? But it's in there. It's sort of a, it's like an old classic. He represents something of a, he's an archetypal person, you know, and he's definitely only going to be here for another probably few years. And He's still alive, though, and Paths to God was about him and his guru. And I'm sure some of you may know that funny story where Ram Dass used to take a lot of LSD and got kicked out of Harvard and all scandalized and all this stuff, right? And so when he was with his guru said, "Give me your acid. I know you're storing it. Give it to me." And then he was like, "What? You know, you're gonna?" He's like, "Yeah, give it all to me." So he went and got it, and then his guru looked at him and took all of it.
Oh!
And then Ram Dass was like, "Oh my God, we've got to call a hospital. This is such a huge. That could kill somebody." And his guru just sat there like nothing happened, right? And Ram Dass couldn't believe it. He just sat there looking at him, and he said, for one moment, he went under his blanket and then came out and was like, "Okay, I'm good." And that's when he knew, like, wow, just something about his presence. How could anyone take, 20 hits of acid and nothing happen? And so that's just one of the funny, and it's so many stories. But the reason I bring that up is that it wasn't just those funny stories. It was the path of purification that he talks about. There was times where he was screaming and crying. There was times where he projected on other people. He grew up for those 7 years that he stayed there. He grew up, and sometimes we don't always understand how hard things can be on this path when you're opening your heart. And Neem Karoli Baba, he would just lie there with the same blanket for like 30 years. And he didn't say a lot. He would say, "You want to love, serve. Do you want to know the path to love? Service. Watch your mind. Just keep serving." And that's kind of been my mantra lately in Oakland. We want to be better. Let's just serve. Right? Let's just and keep our hearts open no matter what comes our way. And so metta is that. Metta helps us do that. And we need a lot of patience for that. A martial arts student went to his teacher and said earnestly, "I am devoted to studying your martial system. How long will it take me to master it?" The teacher's reply was casual, 10 years. Impatiently, the student answered, "But I want to master it faster than that. I'll work very hard. I will practice every day, 10 or more hours if I have to. How long will it take then?" The teacher thought for a moment, smiled, and said, 20 years. Okay. Exactly, right? This kind of mind that's like, give it to me now, right? We're really committing to the long haul when it comes to the transformation of the heart. It's not an overnight thing. We don't get those layers in one day. They come over a lifetime, right? Sometimes they're passed down from our lineage, right? The same things. But what I do know, and I'll just say a couple more things about it, is that I do know from my own practice that the heart longs to be free. It wants to be free. Its nature is to be free. In the Brahma Viharas, are the four heavenly abodes that we talk about, the metta, the compassion, the joy, and the equanimity. These are qualities that we cultivate. Brahma Vihara is a word that we use. It just means heavenly abode. So it's like your mind is a heavenly vehicle when it's centered in those qualities, right? It's like we're going through life in our heaven realm, in our boat, upright, basically, right? Our boat becomes, wherever we go, we're okay. Because if this is okay, you're okay, right? I can be in a difficult situation. If I have a peaceful mind, it's all okay. You could be living in a beautiful home full of Buddha statues and terrified, right? It doesn't give you security necessarily, your external environment. It's really here and here. And so learning the metta practice and taking it up, and we need a lot of patience with ourselves. It's a cultivation. Another little story about patience. So this one's called Two More Aisles. A man observed a woman in a grocery store with a 3-year-old girl in her basket. As they passed the cookie section, the little girl asked for cookies and her mother told her no. The little girl immediately began to whine and fuss. And the mother said, "Now, Monica, we just have half of the aisles left to go through. Don't be upset. It won't be long." Soon they came to the candy aisle and the little girl began to shout for candy. And when told she couldn't have any, began to cry. The mother said, "There, there, Monica. Don't cry. Only two more aisles to go and then we will be checking out." And when they got to the checkout stand, the little girl immediately began to clamor for gum and burst into a terrible, loud tantrum upon discovering that there would be no gum purchased. The mother patiently said, "Monica, we will be through this checkout stand in 5 minutes, and then you can go home and have a nice nap." The man followed them out to the parking lot and stopped the woman to compliment her. "I couldn't help noticing how patient you were with little Monica," he began. Whereupon the mother said, "I am Monica. My little girl's name is Tammy." So we do have certain days like that, right? Where we're just getting through it with compassion. It'll be over soon. Then I can go home. But it's important that we develop a sort of patient, kind attitude toward ourselves. You know, at the end of the day, all you have is loving awareness and the heart. And as I mentioned, the heart longs to be free. In the Brahma Viharas, to circle back to that, they describe these four qualities, metta, compassion, equanimity, and joy, as boundless. In the Metta Sutta, you send metta in every direction. And I've had that sometimes where my heart, it just went out so far and vast. And the heart loves that. It wants to be unbounded. When we bind it together, we get sick. Heart disease is a very serious thing, right? The heart can get sick, not just physically, but it kind of withers when it can't express. Do you notice that? Right, when we shut down love or we don't receive it or we're unwilling to open to it, it's like everything starts to just close off and we live in a very small world. When the heart is really open, and people can remember these moments when their heart opened. I meet people and they'll say, "In 1988, I was on this hill." They remember the one moment where the heart just expanded. And even a moment of that has a huge purifying effect on your consciousness. It's like you see the potential for something in that moment. You see, oh my God, there's no walls. And oftentimes what happens is the ego gets involved and goes, "Nope, get back in the prison," right? But we have the key. And the practices that we do, cultivating the heart. I love Buddhist practice for one really big reason is that we are cultivators. Like, we incline the mind, we practice certain things. And this is what I'm saying tonight. Also, this is not just hippie talk. It's science now. Neuroscience is discovering what compassion really does on the whole system. It's incredible. You should check out some of the work that an organization in San Jose does called HeartMath. And it was formed by neuroscientists, cardiologists, like all the heart specialists in the world, as they started tracking information about heart rhythms, people, the heart, and they started to study it long term, and they're putting out all this beautiful information. Now they say the heart has a brain on it, which is interesting because in Tibetan Buddhism, they call it heart-mind. They don't see it as here. They see it as very much here. So the Western mind, we have this split here, right, a bit, where we live outside of our heart. We live outside of that. We're not embodied in that so much. And I think it's just how we've been conditioned in our culture. And it leads to a lot of problems, right? Because it leads to the I-centeredness. me, I. We don't see the we, us, right? And that's what the heart always sees. The heart goes, what's good for all of us, right? The heart's like, let's share. It's nature. This is not something we have to, you know, we have science telling us this, but this is something we already know deep, deep down. Even children know this, right? Deep down, they're inclined a bit more toward compassion. So these heart practices really work, doing metta practice to deal with the mind and its insanity. We take on practices of loving kindness and cultivate self-love. And when I teach often, I don't teach people to do compassion outside to others so much at first. We already know how to do that in our communities. You know, we already understand the principle of that, but what I see is lacking is the compassion towards self. If your loving kindness and compassion practice does not include you, it's not complete. You have to be the receiving, you have to receive that energy back to you. It can't just be a one-way door where we give out but we don't receive, right? That leads to compassion fatigue and secondary post-traumatic stress and all these syndromes, which means basically a depletion, right? It's like we have to see that the heart has to include ourselves always. So these, you know, these practices, they really, really work. And it's only fear that keeps us. I like Havis, the mystic poet. He used to say, fear is the cheapest room in the house. I'd like to see you living in better conditions. It is the cheapest room in the house, right? It's like the contracted fear. What would happen if we just let go and we included more of ourselves, you know? Loving yourself is the answer. That is kind of what I teach over and over. And even when I try to give Dharma talks on other topics, it's always this. At my sitting group in Oakland for 10 years, I gave almost the same talk over and over. And people go, wow, I love that talk. And I would laugh and go, it was almost the same as last week, you know. But you know what? They forgot. And that's what happens. We forget. Mindfulness is easy. Remembering is hard. Remembering to practice loving ourselves in the moment where we're just going, you know, we're just got our baseball bat or we're judging ourselves or we're harsh or we're critical, right? It's remembering to soften, remembering that every word that you speak has power in your body. You're not registering what's happening as much, but your body is holding it. Your body holds that energy. And a lot of what we're doing now is discovering how much tension is filled in the body, how much suffering the body then breaks down. And it can break down because of self-hatred in a way. It can get depleted on an energetic level. So remembering to wish yourself well and to start seeing yourself as if you see your best friend. That's how we do metta. We take an image of ourselves and we just retrain the mind over and over again. May I be happy and peaceful, may. And you might, as you doing it, you know what will happen as you do heart practice? Rage will come up. Pure rage. On metta retreats, people often walk in, they're going, I hate everyone here. I'm filled with hatred. And they think I'm doing it wrong. I thought, no, this is good. You're doing it right. This is purification. You're doing love practice. Hatred comes. This is what we're encountering. This is what we are, in some way, we take out our heart. It's like a Brillo pad. Sometimes you have to, like, scrub. It hurts. So if you're doing any practice on love, hatred will arise. Embrace it. This is part of it. Also what arises? Sadness. It's almost like when you start opening to this quality in the heart, the iceberg melts. And with it, oceans of tears. In this book by Ram Dass, he was always wailing all the time to his guru, sometimes sobbing on his feet, hysterical. And then Kuruli Baba would just stroke his hair and say, you're going to be all right. It's just part of the process. right? Just keep meditating, keep serving, you know, keep practicing, keep serving. The third thing that you'll notice too when you do metta practice or any heart practice is also that you'll encounter a very deep type of numbness. The numbness is very pervasive. This is after having done so many metta retreats and looking at this issue myself. The numbness is part of also our conditioning. Like, we just go numb from here down. Do you notice that ever? So you'll send love to yourself, but you won't feel it. You'll say, I don't feel it. And this happens to some people for days on the metta retreats. And then one day, it's like the thaw happens. And they're like, oh, this is what everyone's talking about, right? They can finally feel it to themselves. They can do it for their cat. They can do it for, you know, but toward themselves, the numbness. So if that happens to you, touch your body, because you want to almost wake your body up. Your body is an energy. It's alive. And so you want to kind of, that's why when people don't feel metta, I have them place their hand right on their heart and breathe deep until they can feel heat. Say, can you feel heat? And they'll say, okay, I feel some heat. And I say, just stay with that until the words and the imagery, until you feel the emotion. So in some way, the numbness is fear. And so we have to kind of bring ourselves out of the coma of that to let the heart kind of have its warmth. The heart is very warm, right? It walks into a room and it goes, hello. You know, it's kind of like a big hug. That's what it wants to do. If we got out of the way, that's what it would do. It would serve, it would be loving, it would serve, it would be loving, it would, you know. That's its nature. That's at least what I've seen for myself. So on that note, I'm going to just stop. And you know, my book is full of stories about how the challenges of life can be heart-opening. That's what I call fierce, is like meeting the storms with a sense of being upright. And there's a lot of stories about my own life and trauma and drama and all the things that come and how to use it to wake up. That's my new philosophy. All of the mess is the message. If we can hear it, I learned from suffering. I learned from that. And now I've come to appreciate it. And I'm learning all the time. Last year, I had a huge learning. After all the political, I thought, oh my God, wow, this too? My heart has to open to this too now? Oh my God. Of course it does, right? Of course. Expansion. Expansion. So, and that doesn't mean I have people over for dinner who are cruel and, you know, that doesn't mean no boundaries. But it means having boundless capacity. And it means always looking at what we're forgiving and understanding is greed, hatred, and delusion. It's not the being behind it. It's the mind of the confused mind. That's what I relate to when I see people acting in certain ways. It's like, that confusion. Confusion also is dangerous. You know, their confusion could kill me. So I take care of myself, right? But it's not with hatred. It's not with that quality. That just weakens me. And that's not what my heart wants. I've tried. And love overthrows it. So thank goodness for that. So I'm going to stop there and see if you have any questions for the last few minutes of our class. And thank you all for listening. I can go on and on about this. I want to see, is there any questions that anyone has? I think we have a microphone and we could pass it. Do we need that? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Thank you, Femi. Yes.
First of all, I just wanted to say thank you very much for that talk. I also recently went on my first 2-week retreat and I had some really similar opening experiences like that, and I had to sort of jump right back into life, and I was moving, and then I went on this really hectic, busy trip, and I was wondering if there's anything more you could say on the topic of integration or any advice you could give about that.
Yeah, integration. So you're saying he just went on a two-week retreat. Well, one of the things you'll learn after you do that a few times is you won't schedule big life, you know. At first we're like, yeah, I could do that. I could go on this big retreat and then 5 minutes later go to this concert, move out of my place, and then, you know, start a new job. Then after a while we go, ah. So that comes with the territory, right? You kind of get it. But I think integration is everything. You know, self-realization is nothing until it's lived in the world, and integrating takes time, right? You go on a retreat, and then you have to kind of figure out, it's like you went from, you know, scuba divers, how they have to go down and they have to acclimatize every 10 feet? That's what you have to learn in this, like, you go on these retreats, you have these huge openings, and then, now I have to live it in my house with my crazy roommates or my relationships or my job, and it takes a lot of care and kindness, because we'll fall down. And I think that's the part to be humble about, right? And also in the beginning of our practice, there's a big swing. I used to go on these 3-month retreats, and then I'd be like a nun for 3 months. And then as soon as I got back to Oakland, I would go, wah, you know, drinking games. This was in my 20s. And I would like lose mindfulness. I hate meditation. No. The pendulum would swing way over here. And then I would wake up like 3 weeks later and go, what am I doing? And then it would come here. Right? So there's these like swings as we adapt to the person, like we're evolving. And so it takes time. And sometimes when we go and have a big spiritual experience, we often leave our life behind. So sometimes it's all messy and then we escape off. And then we have all these experiences. And then we come home and it's like, oh my gosh, there's dishes in the sink, all these bad things going on in my relationship, right? So we have to come home and sort of do the laundry. There's a great book, After the Ecstasy, The Laundry, because that's like coming home, right? It's a mess in here and I've got to sort my bills. And so our lives have to catch up to it. They catch up to our heart and our mind. And it will slowly do that. It'll just, you know, yeah. That's a great question. So be gentle on yourself and just know. Now I warn people that they might swing all the way back over here when they leave an intense experience. So that's kind of like a little backlash too, right? So, and then you'll find your center though again. Yeah, thank you. Any others? About the practice or even sharing anything? Yes.
I have a question. I'm beginning to experience the being as a portal, kind of, and it's really easy for me to love what comes through me, and it doesn't exactly feel like me. It feels like a flow of something that's not, and I don't know if that's not loving the self, like I'm not loving some parts of me, or what's your thoughts on that? Because it feels like even the practice, like the shifts that happen in the alignment and the way you move, so it starts to feel like it's sort of an other movement moving through the body.
Yeah, I mean, at times we open up to a lot of different energy that comes through. It's kind of, you know, we are just pure energy. So on some level, as we open up, there's energetic phenomenon. I think I would probably have to tune in more, because we can tell stories about that energy. We might not always know what it is. Some of the stuff is very mysterious. Yeah. And then we don't know what to make of it. So we could either create a good scenario or a bad scenario. Like, this thing is happening to my neck. I think it's my grandmother, and, you know, we don't know what it is. So we kind of, and so I think we have to be really careful to just stay super grounded, right? And we just opening up, energy, yes, it's shifting. There's, honestly, I could get into a lot around energy and all the phenomena that comes with meditation practice. You know, on the quantum level, if I was, you know, looking at this thing here on a quantum level, is nothing's here, it's just moving parts. So our body is the same if I look really closely. So we can access this level at times, like between the energy, the pure energy body, and we can sort of lean into that and go, wait, oh my gosh, what's going on here? And then we kind of lean back into the solidity again. So I think just opening to it all as a mystery and not telling stories about it. I let go of a lot of stuff, like, don't know mind, okay, coming back. You know, so that could be helpful. Just kind of let go. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Anybody else? Yeah, in the back there.
This question relates a little bit to the question before the gentleman. Can you talk a little bit about resistance? And it's kind of like when I come back from a retreat, I find myself knowing that I don't need to get into habits which are not conducive to, you know, mindfulness, but I just don't seem to be able to stop myself. You know, there just seems to be this real kind of obstructionist energy. And so I was wondering if you had any insights about that.
Yeah. I mean, how many of you can relate to that? Like, there's something in your life that you're like, this is not helpful. Just raise your hand so everyone can get, like, I think this is our human condition, right? It's like, I know this thing I should let go of. I go to retreat to work on it, yet as soon as I hit my door, right, it's like, onto that thing, you know? I mean, I think that one thing is the patience. That's why I brought it up. That, you know, in the Dharma, in the teachings, it says that we're deeply conditioned. We have deep conditioned patterns. So if we look at it from neuroscience, neuroplasticity, there are these deeply ingrained grooves in the mind, right? Taking that approach. And it takes time to dig a new path. So you know paths through the woods. I'm sure there's a lot of walking trails around here, right? And you have to clear those walking trails every year, I bet, as soon as after the winter. Otherwise, they disappear, right? But then when you clear them and they get well walked on, they're a groove, right? And it's like, wow, right through there. We have to just know that what we're doing with our practices, and that is another reason why coming through the heart door is much more powerful with working with some of these. If we just try to use sheer discipline, like, stop it, or use a baseball bat, which is what we actually secretly do, right? We take it out and go, if you do this one more time, and then we do, and then the whack happens, and then we do it more because we're whacking ourselves, and usually whatever our habits are, they're coping mechanisms in some way. So I think it's to really approach all of these aspects of our being and our habits and our compulsions and what feels overwhelming with a lot of heart, because at the end of the day, it's love and compassion that lets go. It's not wrathfulness. It's the love that goes, honey, you know, that's really painful. And we sort of, yeah, okay. And we just walk the other direction, right? I no longer want to walk on that path. And so I would really, really encourage you when it's happening or whatever, that you come and you just be with yourself in a loving way, like compassion. Like, whatever is happening here, I want to open to it with kindness. I want to feel what's going on. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes we don't want to feel things. And that's a big problem. We don't want to feel. And you're not going to grow if you don't want to feel, because this path is all about feeling stuff. Right? And we have to feel the energies and feel our way through to let them go. Everybody wants to know about the First Noble Truth, which is about suffering without suffering. Right? It's like, can I just go to that level? Right? And it's like, there's a huge gap there. And the feelings, the thing about the feelings is you will grow from them. They're not a mistake. You could actually use those, like, we feel like, oh, this is just going to waste my time. I got to feel all this. I don't need it. I don't want it. I already did it. I, you know. But there's something in meeting it. There's an opening there. And meeting things how they are. Our grief, our sorrow, our rage, our fear. There's something about learning to open to it, that there's a wisdom in the opening. There's an intelligence. There's a lesson that comes that, that's what I was trying to really get at here. So try to just meet that with love. Every time that thought of it even comes, you use that as your compassion practice, not as the baseball bat. Try that. Yeah. Give yourself like a month of it and see what happens. Yeah. So I hope that's helpful in some way. Yeah. So just a couple more moments. We're going to end a little bit early tonight because I'm going to sign some books for those who would like to do that. But anyone else that, yeah, anything that, question or anything? Okay. Get the microphone. Okay, so I'm going to read one thing for I read this the other night from, it's from the Aborigine woman who says, if you have come to help me, you are wasting your time. If you have come because your liberation is bound up with mine, let us work together. So that's why I came. I'll read it again. If you have come to help me, you are wasting your time. But if you have come because your liberation is bound up with mine, let us work together. So that's the last thing, is the heart knows the interconnectedness. That's a big piece of heart math's work. Is they have a big project called the Renaissance. Resonance. I can never say that word. The Resonance Project, where they're saying all hearts are linked, almost like trees in the forest. So at the end of the day, our lives are inextricably interwoven. So I want to really thank you all for coming out tonight. It's really been very sweet, and I hope that this was helpful for you in some way. Tomorrow we are having a Women's Day Long for all self-identified women. If that is you, if you identify as that, please come. It's called Wisdom Rising. We are going to have kind of a lively group in here. It's a few women, a lot of women signed up. And well, we will explore that theme. And on Sunday, I'll be here as well. So if you want to come out for Sunday, I'll be talking about the wisdom of inclusivity. And again, about the heart and expanding to include all beings, how it's a liberating practice. I'll share some of my own stories about that, creating our community in Oakland. So, just deep bows. And I'll be here. And I think Mr. Femi has some announcements.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.